This is Tom Harris. I'm interviewing Gil McDougald at his home in Spring Lake, New Jersey. Today's date is January 24th, 1994. Gil, you were born May 19th, 1928, San Francisco. Did you grow up there?
Yes, we grew up in San Francisco, and I have one brother, no sisters, and my father now is living out Midwest in Minnesota, and he's got a large family, and he enjoyed watching kids the same way I've enjoyed watching my children grow up here.
When and where did you learn to play ball?
Well, we learned to play baseball in the sand lots in San Francisco, and at that time, baseball was at probably its high point in San Francisco, and many ball players came from that area, and I think they all started the same way, playing on the sand lots, then you graduate maybe and playing in high school and then to college, or often guys skipped college and went into the minor league system.
What was the name of your high school?
Well, I wound up going to high school at Commerce High School, and then after high school I went to college for 1 year and then signed a pro contract. I was undecided what I wanted to do, but eventually I decided I wanted to play ball and give it a shot.
Okay, what position did you play in high school?
Okay, I played basically in high school. I pitched a little and played infield position. At that time, everybody had trouble hitting the curveball a little, and I think that's why I ruined my art throwing curveballs all that time.
Okay. How did you do in high school?
I surprisingly did pretty well pitching, and I never was very big at that stage, and I'm still not a big, but at least then I was about 5'7", 5'8", at the most in high school, and I couldn't have weighed probably 140. And so I grew late. After my senior year, I started to grow and put on weight, and that's when all of a sudden I started to learn to hit a little better, you know.
Okay, how was the team?
The team did fairly well. We were always competitive at Commerce, but at that time there was a couple other high schools, Galileo High School and Mission High School, that were extremely good in baseball.
What did you do after high school?
Joe Devine signed me as a scout out there. He was the West Coast scout and head scout at that time. And Joe signed many good ball players. He was the one instrumental in getting Joe DiMaggio to come back in 1935, I think it was, to the Yankees. Of course, with my era, he got Coleman, Silvera, Bobby Brown, all them players. We had an all-San Francisco ball club in 1951 when we went out to spring training in Phoenix, Arizona. We switched from St. Petersburg, and we filled it in spring training in all San Francisco night, and Joe Devine almost signed all the players.
Okay, so Joe Devine is the scout that signed you, right? Joe Devine, is that his name?
My first year I played professional ball at Twin Falls, Idaho, and that was in the Pioneer League. Then I went on and played my second year at Victoria in the Western International. In my third year I played at Beaumont, Texas in the Texas League, my third year. And I played second base strictly.
Do you remember any of the managers? Do you remember any of the managers you played for and how you did in those minor league years?
Yes, I remember all my managers. In Twin Falls, we had Charlie Metro, who was a former major leaguer that never really probably was an outstanding star, but he was a good outfielder and he played the infield also. And then we went up to Victoria. Ted Norbert was our manager up there, and Ted was a player that played for the San Francisco Seals for like 10, 12 years. And my third year at Belmont, I played under Roger Hornsby, the great Hall of Famer. And Roger was a person that you better put out on the ball field, otherwise you wouldn't be there, you know.
He was very demanding?
That was the only thing that he thought was important in life, was baseball. And if you didn't play it like you liked it and enjoyed it and played it hard, you wouldn't be with him very long, you know.
Did he know the game very well? Did he know the game very well?
Right after our year in Belmont, he went up to manage the Cincinnati Reds, and that's when I went up to the Yankees, and he brought three other ball players from our ball club with him for Cincinnati at that time.
How and when were you called up to the Yankees?
Well, actually, they didn't really call you up. It's like after my third year at Belmont, they send you a contract, and my contract was to Kansas City, which was AAA ball club at the time. And I had told Joe Devine at the time I would give baseball 3 years. If I didn't make it in 3 years, I was going to try some other line of business. And he got upset at me because when I got the contract for playing the next year, they cut me after I was the most valuable player in the Texas League. They cut my salary $50 a month. So I wasn't too interested. I wrote a letter to Clark Carroll, who later became the president of the Kansas City Major League Club. And I told him what I thought of him, you know. And in the meantime, then all of a sudden he calls up George Weiss at the Yankees. George Weiss then calls Joe Devine. And it became a real round robin. So Joe comes running to me and he's mad as heck at me. And I said, Joe, why are you mad at me? I told you I'd give you 3 years. If he doesn't think I'm good enough, why don't you trade me to some other ball club? And I says, maybe they'll think I'm interesting enough to play for it. So they then sent me to Phoenix. That was the year 51 they switched their camp. And I said, well, great, because it's close to San Francisco. It's only after go down, you know, 500-600 miles, and I said, it's no big deal. If I don't make it, I'll just hop, you know, on a plane and go home. In the meantime, I didn't want to be on the other side of the country, and that's one of the reasons they hang a lot of ball players at that time, and he's trying to cheat because the guy has no way of getting home, you know. Things in the minors weren't what you'd call very nice at that time, you know.
Low pay, right?
Yeah, I think I got $200 a month in my first year. They thought I was overpaid, you know.
Okay, you remember your first major league game?
Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't remember the first major league game I played until Bob Hurley joined our ball club. And he told me, Gil, the first game that you played in the majors, I pitched against you, and you hit a homer and a double off me. I thought I couldn't even remember it. I didn't, at that time, I was so, I guess, focused on the game of baseball that I wasn't worrying about names or people or anything else. I was just zeroing in on playing the game. So I didn't really remember who was pitching or what team it was. I couldn't tell you, you know.
Okay, well, you started off pretty nice. You're rookie. You're named Rookie of the Year in 51.
Yeah,
tell me about that.
It was a year that I had a pretty good year once I started to play regular, but I felt a little bad because I thought that, you know, Minnie Minoso had a good year with the White Sox, and I thought basically he deserved it more than I. The difference, I think, was exposure in New York against Chicago, more newspapers in New York, more exposure, and everything becomes a little better if you play for New York than it really is, you know.
What's the biggest difference between the majors and the minors?
Well, I think, as far as I'm concerned, the condition makes it easier to play in the majors. And the only reason I remember this was my first year with the Yankees, we barnstormed back from San Francisco back through Texas. And now I started playing in AAA ballparks, which eventually, like Los Angeles and San Francisco, that were real fine AAA ballparks, good lighting. We went back to Beaumont, and all my guys in the club said, how could you possibly hit here? He's got the candle lights, you know? And that's when I realized, all of a sudden, wow, these lights are bad. But then when I got to Yankee Stadium and started playing at some of these other ballparks where all of a sudden, I mean, it's beautiful playing at night and there's no shadows or anything. And I got used to playing night ball because in the minors you played all night ball. And so I was happy they played more night ball than day ball.
Okay. In 1951, win the World Series against the Giants. You hit a grand slam in Game 5. You had 7 RBIs. That must have been great.
When you play in a World Series, it's hard to say who's going to have the good series or good games. It seems to me like most of the time, the real stars of the team never do as well as some of the people they don't expect to do well.
That's right.
And I remember hitting that grand slam, and that was a thrill, only a thrill in respect. We won the game.
Right.
And it broke open the game, and won the game
13-0.
Yes. But otherwise, it means you're just lucky when you come up with a lot of men on in certain situations,
yeah.
And that's going to dictate if you get lucky and you get a hit or something. You're a big hero. You strike out, they read it in reverse. That's all.
The Giants, Bobby Thompson's home run, everything, all of that going into the series. Do you remember what it was like going into that series?
Well, the funny thing, we didn't go over that day because we were waiting for Bobby Thompson and the Dodgers to get their playoff over. And all the guys went over. The Dodgers, I believe, won the first game. The Giants came back, or just the reverse. The
Giants won the first in Ebbets Field.
Well, I think it was Lapine.
Lapine shut them out in the second game.
He pitched a heck of a game. And all our guys were rooting for the Giants, and Stengel got mad as heck at us. And looking, why are you getting mad? Okay, he said, I think we can beat the Dodgers. I don't think we can beat the Giants. The guys are. The difference is there's 56,000 people that come to the Polo Grounds, and there's only about 33. And the difference is quite a few $1,000 to each player. So they could tell us, all the guys, they wanted to play in a big park where the World Series bonus was more than you made in the year's salary. I made more in the series that year than I made in the entire year playing ball.
Very interesting. Okay. The Yankees won 8 pennants, 5 world championships during your career there. Which one stands out the most?
Well, I think each one in itself stands out, but I think the one that I enjoyed the most was when I played shortstop for the complete year in 1957. And it was a transition year for the ball club because Phil had quit, and there was no shortstop in our Yankee chain that Casey had confidence in, and he asked me if I would try playing shortstop. And I said, no big deal. I'll try to play it if you don't like me. I'd play another position, you know? But I found that why you like it is you're like the center of the stage. You see every pitch. It's easier to position yourself when you see every pitch that's being called by the catcher. So you're ready to move in whatever direction you feel according to the pitch and the batter, which way is it going to pull it, or will it be behind the pitch and hit the other way? So that became more interesting to me, you know, where you play third base. It's a position you just stay there and you wait for somebody to hit a ball out of ground here or bunt. But you can play a whole game at third base and not have anything happen.
You played three different positions for the Yankees. You were brought up as a second baseman. Did you have a favorite position to play? I guess shortstop from what you're saying.
Well, everybody's asked me the question, which one did they think I played the best. And I always thought second base was my best position, basically because I had played it more through the minors. But when I came up, everybody said I was about a third baseman, they felt. And I didn't like third base as much. But then when I got to play shortstop, everyone said, well, he's too tall, he's too gangly, and he's too this, he doesn't have the good arm of feather. It just proves that, you know, when somebody reacts that way to you, it becomes a bigger challenge. And I think I proved I could play the position pretty well.
Your batting stance was an open one early on. Did you develop that stance yourself?
My batting stance was considered odd only when I started playing pro ball.
Right.
And actually, I guess I developed that playing sandlot ball, and nobody ever made a comment about it. But once you play pro ball and there's sports writers, all of a sudden they start writing about it, and all of a sudden, you know, that became like the center of attention all the time. They never talked about my fielding or something. It was always about how I held the bat. And the funny thing about it is if they looked at a film, when the ball was just on its way, my hand went up, and it didn't just hang that way and swing the way somebody would describe it. Because once the ball is being thrown to you, it's funny. Everybody then watches the ball. They don't watch the hitter. And me, so that's how sports writers wrote. They look at your preliminary, the way I held the bat, and they thought it was odd. But if you look at the hitting position of my hands as any other hitter, they're almost in an identical spot when the pitch was coming over the plate, you know?
Okay, now, did Casey Stengel ask you to change your stance?
Yeah.
And how did it affect you?
Well, it affected me only in the respect that I got mad as heck because I felt I was hitting the ball well, but Casey, thinking like a good manager that he was, he was mad because I always pulled the ball with my old stance because it was open. I'd always wanted to get out in front of the ball. And the problem was I'd hit a shot to left field. The base runner in first would only go to second. He couldn't go any further. And he wanted me to spray the ball to center, the right center and right field, so the runner can go from first to third, which is what you really want when you're playing ball. And then if there's one out, you know, it takes away the bunt situation. If you only advance from one base, then maybe the next guy's got a bunt to get him into a better scoring position, you know?
Who was the toughest pitcher that you faced in your time in the majors?
They all were tough for me, but I think the pitcher that I enjoyed facing, and when he had his great year, was really tough, was Bobby Chance.
Oh, really? Yeah?
Yeah, Bobby had that sneaky fastball, and he had a great curve that year when he won 24 games,
52, I think.
Yeah.
Philadelphia.
And, yeah, and he was the MVP and that. And besides that, he turned out to be one of my best friends. And of course, you know, it's funny. I remember when he came to us, where Bobby's arm was really hurt, and he used to take shots with needles to kill the pain, and it used to kill me just to watch him, and you know he was hurting out there, but he never showed it.
Now, you retired after 1960. What caused you retire? Were you injured?
Well, I had told the organization a year before, in fact, coming home from the World Series, coming home after the season, because I think we finished on the road, and I went up to Casey on the way home, and I told him, Casey, look, get somebody prepared to play whatever position you want them to play that I would be playing, because at the end of next year, I'm quitting, irregardless of whether I was the MVP or whatever. And I said, I don't anticipate it, but I said, and it wouldn't bother me if you had played somebody and I had to sit on the bench. It ain't gonna bother me if that's what you want to do. Well, as it turned out, nobody believed me, including George White. So at the end of the 60 season, I had a fair year. And they thought, when I went in, they said, you know, I told them, well, it's great playing for your case, and I wish you the best of luck, etc. In the meantime, I knew he was going to talk to George Weiss about it, and in the meantime, that was the year that they had the switch and the new franchise that started out in California and Washington. And so they had to protect X amount of ball players. And they told me, the organization, afterwards in the phone call, that, don't worry, Gil, you're protected. Then I got a call from my buddy, Joe Reichler, who was the sports editor of the AP at that time. And Joe said, Gil, you're not protected. I'm calling for the general who owned the club down there in 1960, bought the club. And he wants you to play for him. And I said, Joe, I wouldn't play for down in Washington, no matter how much money he paid me. I just don't like Washington area. And secondly, I said, Joe, I told you I'm going to retire. Well, then not more than, I would say, 3 weeks go by, he calls me again. And he says, Gil, Washington had given the California Angels the right to claim part of with me in hopes that I'd go back to California, my home state, and possibly play for them. But Gene Autry at that time, he called me 5 nights in a row trying to entice me with dollars and everything else. And I said, I finally told him, fine, Gene, my last day, I decided I'll play for you on one condition. I only play a home game. He says, you can't do that. Well, I said, then you got your answer. I said, I don't want to go on the road anymore. I don't want to be away from the family anymore. And that's how it ended up. Then I called Joe, and I said, Joe, look, whenever you want, you write the story any way you want, I'm retiring. So I don't want to tell any of the other guys, I prefer you doing it. And I said, real simple, you can put it any way you want. At that time, you know, I had started a business, and they all of us started the business in 57. And in the meantime, they didn't believe that, you know, I quit. So I said, Joe, release the story. I said, then they'll know. But the problem was the Yankees were really upset with me because I think they lost 200,000 because whoever drafted me would have to compensate the Yankees. And in the meantime, I was so mad at the organization because they really lied to me, you know, and told me I was protected.
Right.
And I think that's the number one thing you couldn't do in business. And that's the one thing I never did. I wouldn't lie to somebody, and I had a lot of people working for me. And I said, you know, I'd at least be truthful with them, you know.
Okay. After you retired, I understand you coached some college ball. Can you tell me about that and what other involvement you had with the game?
Yes, I went over and coached Fordham University baseball team. Part of the reason is twofold. Peter Carlesimo at that time was the athletic director, and now Peter Carlesimo Jr. is a coach at Seton Hall.
Right.
Well, I knew Pete, and Pete was at the University of Scranton at that time, and he was just coming over to Fordham to be the athletic director. He says, "Gil, our program is really in bad shape. Would you think about it?" At that time, I had my company set up pretty good in 1970 about, so I had been in business about 14 years. And I said, "Pete, you get somebody that's probably better than me and interested more." So then I come home and I happen to tell my wife and family at dinner, and they said, "Doug, it would be a great idea. You go over and have fun." And so I thought about it. And I went back and I called them and I said, "Hey, Pete, look, as long as you tell me I don't have to win one game, as long as I'm there, I'll try." So I went over and it really turned out to be enjoyable until my hearing started to go and it started to get bad. And then I decided, you know, look, let my assistant run the club and be the new coach, which Pete did. And my assistant took over Fordham, and he did very well. But then it's a tough place to get a lot of kids to come who are good ball players, because it's too cold in the spring. You don't play enough good games in good weather. So most of the good kids that are more advanced in baseball go south and play, you know.
How long did you live? How many years did you coach at Fordham?
I think I coached 7 years over there. And
did you do anything else in baseball other than coaching at Fordham?
Not really. I did scout for George Weiss. When he called me, I felt it was a way, if there was any obligation on my part, this was a good way to end the obligation. And I scouted for him in 1961. Which was his first year when the Yanks fired him,
right.
And he went over to the Mets, and Casey went over there. And I scouted for him in this basic New Jersey area. And only for 3 months, that was our deal, 3 months. And I said, "Fine, I want to be paid, I want anything." If you've got a specific team at that time, you had the AAA ball club down in Jersey City at that time. And I said, "If you want me to scout for AAA, fine. If you want me to look at a specific college player or a high school player, no problem, you know." And that's what I did for him.
Okay, your manager for your entire career was Casey Stengel. If you could tell me your memories about Casey, what was it like playing for him?
Well, I guess it's funny. The first 5 years, I played for Casey Stengel. It was the worst years I think I ever put in baseball. He was on me constantly, and everybody on the ball club just couldn't understand why every day, if we're having a meeting going over somebody, that'll get on my butt for something. And I used to get so mad at him, they'd see the smoke coming out of my head. And so finally, in 1955, we lost the World Series to the Dodgers that year, and we all went over to Japan. And when we got over there, Casey asked me, he says, "Gil, would you be interested, you know, in playing short for me, because Phil didn't make the trip?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll play short. Billy Martin, I can play it. And, so, you know, whatever one you want to play, we'll take it." In the meantime, one night, he had said, "The bar in the hotel is off base." So, I said, 1 o'clock in the morning, I was hot as heck. And I came down, and we all had our wives there. And I went down, I said, "I'm going to have a beer." And it was warm. So I went down, I'm sitting at the bar, nobody's there, nobody. I looked around first, nobody's there. In the back, there's Casey, you know? I didn't see him when I went in, and then I hear all these Japanese sports writers were interviewing him and stuff. And all of a sudden, I thought, oh, now he's running now. So I said, what's he going to find me? I said, it's not during the season, so he can't find me much. As it turned out, he came up to me, and he says, who's the best pitching coach in baseball? I said, it's Jim Turner. You signed him. And he says, I didn't ask you that. I asked you, who's the best baseball coach in baseball is? And he says, well, hell, everybody knows that Cleveland pitching coach is the best pitching coach. That's the way to answer, he says, you know. Then he sat down with me and had a drink. And I said, Case, I got to ask you a question. Yeah, you must hate my guts. I says, 5 years now, there isn't one thing I've ever done that's made you happy. Why don't you just get rid of me, and you'll save a lot of aggravation, and I'll certainly won't get an ulcer which got to come along, and we'll both be a lot happier, you know? He says, look, I'm not trading you ever. And I says, hey, why are you getting on my butt? And he says, very simple. He says, you're a better ball player when you're mad. And he says, I planned on keeping you mad, you know? Well, after that, I understood, because he says, what do you think would happen if I got on Phil Rizzuto that way? I says, no comment, you know, because some people have thin skin and some have thick skin, and with me, I'd get mad, but the question is other people might get mad and quit on him. And that's what he was afraid of, you know. So he used me, my locker was right next to Phil, to shake up Phil or somebody else. He used him, and that's why everybody was wondering, you know, why he was going to have me. But that was something about him. He knew his ball players. That's what made him a great manager. And he knew who to prod, who not to prod, like, beat Mickey with kid gloves because he was afraid if he said something to Mickey, he'd go brood or something, you know. And he knew the pitchers to get mad at. He knew the pitchers not to get on. That's part of managing, and it's part of the same thing when you're in business. You've got to know your personnel, and if you don't, shame on you.
What was your opinion of his managing style? Did you like how he moved players around in
well,
and out?
Well, Casey, I believe, was what I would call a hunch manager a lot of times. Casey would try something that basically other managers, he'd go against the book, so to speak. In other words, I've seen him sometime when a left-hander came in to pitch. Instead of going to right-hander, he put up a left-hander like Woodling, the pinch hitter or something. Because he says, when you ask him, you know, why would you do something like that? He says, because this left-handed pitcher threw his slider, he always jammed a right-hander. And if it was a left-hander, it'd be out over the plate and hit the fat part of the bat or something. And he'd always have an answer why. And he was always good at pulling pinch hitter. He just seemed to know what hitter to get that type of pitching that was being thrown that particular day against him. And that's when you start thinking ahead and really involved in the game. And Casey, I thought, was myself one of the better managers. He wasn't afraid to make moves where a lot of other managers would, you know. If you go with supposedly your best ball players, it's hard for sports writers to criticize you. But if you go against the book, that's when sports writers can really jump on people, you know?
That's true. Did you ever see him again after you retired?
Yeah, I've seen Casey a couple of times after he retired at banquets and stuff. Because at that time, I was still pretty involved around the metropolitan area. And I've seen him at most of the time it would have been during the winter, and at a banquet or some sports writer's dinner or something like that. And I never can say I was close to him because he lived in Glendale, California during the winter, so I really, all I'd see him was when you had a big dinner or something. And I was going to mostly all the big dinners that pertained to baseball at that time.
Okay. You played shortstop for Don Larsen's perfect game in the 56 series. Tell me your memories of the game.
Well, I guess the thing I remembered most was the last out, and Dale Mitchell was up. And Dale at that time played for Cleveland for years, and Dale was the type of guy that never struck out. So everybody's saying, oh boy, somebody's going to have to catch the ball and throw him out. And I was playing short, and I says, hey, that's where Dale Mitchell always hit. And I'll never forget, I think it was probably one of the few bad pitches that, you know, he threw. And I thought the pitch was really borderline. It could have been called either way, but Pampinelli called
two strikes on you.
And when a pitch is that close in that type of a game, I believe Dale should have swung him back, you know. But you got to understand, when you're a good hitter like Dale, you're disciplined. And normally speaking, that borderline pitch is given to a good hitter most of the time. And they might give you the pitch low. In the American League, which normally high ball umpires, and the National League low ball umpires, they said. And this was surprising because it was a National League umpire that called them out on that pitch, which surprised me, you know. But that was my best memory. I had one other thing happen in that game, was a ball that I went into the hole for that. It ricocheted off Andy Carey, and Jackie Robinson had hit it, and I threw him out at first, and it was really a bang-bang play. And that they wrote up as one of the big plays that really saved the no-hitter at that time, you know.
You played with many great players in the Yankees. I'm going to state some of their names. I'd like you to tell me something about them, maybe an incident, a short story, anything you recall about them. Describe what the person was like, on or off the field. Phil Rizzuto, you mentioned before.
Well, Phil, it was a real pleasure playing with Phil when I played second or third, because especially when I played second, and you had to be an infielder to appreciate him because of the way he threw the ball for you, like on a double play. He had the light throw, and it was easy to handle for a second baseman to complete the double play. And Phil, to me, was pretty much the key to our ball club for a lot of years that I was first there, like from 51 on. Because if you don't have that good shortstop up the middle, too many balls that could turn into double plays, you only get one out, and then all of a sudden that one out you don't get back comes out to haunt you afterwards. And Phil, in my book, was extremely important to the Yankees at that time.
How about Allie Reynolds?
Allie Reynolds, is a crime that Allie isn't in the Hall of Fame. And it just amazes me that he hasn't been considered years ago, because at that time, Allie not only should be in based on his record as it is, but Allie used to relieve as well as start. And he relieved against all our tough clubs in all the tough situations, and they didn't give any recognition to this, where now you see them put Hall of Famers in a relief pitcher. I mean, here you got a great starter and a super reliever, and they didn't even consider him. It amazes me, because if you went and asked ball players of our time, who was probably the most outstanding pitcher, there's no question Allie Reynolds would be number one or two. In fact, in my book, every fifth is stopped that Sandy Koufax had.
Really?
well, everyone called him a right-handed ballpark with a curveball was similar. But I even wrote a letter last year. Oklahoma gave Ali a day, and I had a fellow write me and ask me if I'd write a short letter saying something about Ali. They could read up the testimonial dinner they gave him. And then I said, well, I'll go one step further. I'll write a letter for the Hall of Fame, and which I did, and I never have done that for anyone else. But it really bothers me sometimes when you know certain person deserves wholeheartedly to be there, and he's not recognized, yet other people get in, and you gotta laugh, you know, and say, hey, they're nice guys, but you mean to tell me he's better than this guy, you know? That's the thing that turns you off, because the Hall of Fame, the thing that bothers everybody about it, there's no prerequisites of what you have to do to get in. They don't say you got to play 20 years or 2 years. They don't say you have to hit 400 or 250, you know, or you got to win 400 games or win 50 games. There's no rules on what you have to do. They don't tell you got to be a great fielder, great thrower, great hitter. Everything is now, you know, guy's a great hitter, but he's a bad outfielder, he's a slow runner, you know, but he's still a Hall of Famer. And I'm saying, to me, when we went in to pull ball, they told us, if you can't do three things, you aren't even considered as a major leaguer. And those three things were it, you know, hit, run, and throw. If you can't do them well, how can you be considered for the Hall of Fame? This is my thinking.
How about Johnny Mize?
Big Johnny Mize. Johnny was a great hitter. Another guy that he just came into the Hall of Fame recently,
right.
And John was a power hitter, but the homers a few years, I know. And he also was a man that struck out very few times, which is very unusual for a power hitter. And Johnny Mize, after playing with him on the same ball club, John playing first base, I think, had one of the surest hands at catching a ball.
Really?
A thrown ball of just about anybody I've seen. The problem with John, he couldn't get off the dime. You know, he couldn't move the field ball. To me, that wasn't important, because when I played second, I just leaned a little more toward where John was if a left-handed hitter was up that I knew could pull the ball. And so you more or less protect each other. And when I played third base, I'd move off the line to protect the hole more, so Phil could play closer to second base. And that's the way you make double plays, you know.
Eddie Lopez.
Eddie Lopez, great left-handed pitcher. Eddie was probably the pitcher that more hitters hated to face than anybody, because with all the junk he threw, he could really foul up a hitter's timing. And Eddie was a great competitor. Eddie, in my book, was another one of them guys that if he could have thrown a little harder with all the other assortments he had, I tell you what, he'd be one of the untouchables that, you know, as far as a baseball pitcher goes, because Eddie had great control. Eddie probably could throw the ball on the dime 9 out of 10 times. And when he said he was going to pitch a guy away, you knew he was going to pitch him away. And when he said he was going to pitch him in, he'd pitch him in. And a lot of pitchers nowadays are not pitchers, they're throwers. They throw the ball, but they have no idea where the ball is going. So how can you, as an infielder, position yourself accordingly if the guy doesn't pitch according to the way he says he's going to? That becomes a difficulty when you play with guys that are throwers instead of pitchers.